This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Zach Velisi. Today on our podcast, President Biden has unveiled his long-awaited infrastructure plan, the risks and the potential, with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman.
Never have more people had access to capital, and never have there been more problems to solve. So the raw material is there for a real explosion of creative destruction.
Pfizer's vaccines are still proving safe, and Johnson & Johnson seems to have contained the jab drama.
That lot has itself been quarantined. Which is a weird word to use for what you do to a vaccine.
Plus, baseball is back. Opening day and the return of sports with Red Sox chairman Tom Werner.
The bond that fans have with their local sports team is so strong. And in an era of disruption, sports really is must carry, whether it's the NFL or the NBA or MLB.
Those stories, plus Elon Musk has another job to add to his resume. No joke. It's Thursday, the first day of April.
April 1st, yes, April Fool's Day.
Squawk Pod begins right now.
Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I'm just trying to make sure I don't get fooled by something now that I've been warned.
I know. I was trying to think of a joke that I could pull over on you, but I knew that you'd be wise to the ways of this.
No, I wasn't.
Something better
until I read
than that stupid
I wasn't
VW
until I read
joke.
It. Yeah, I wasn't until I read it. But now, you know, on Twitter and stuff, I'm going to take everything with more of a grain of salt. Andrew, does the New York Times
I'm
do anything?
April
Foolishly, or anything in the Sorkin household? I mean, were you aware it was April 1st?
You know, I was going to do this a little later because I don't know if she's watching the show, but I think you may know this. Today is my mother's birthday on April Fool's Day.
It's always
been the case.
Happy birthday,
in the
Mrs. Sorkin.
Households. So, nice. And both of you have met my mother, I believe. Yeah. So, happy birthday, Mom. We love you, and this is not an April Fool's Day joke.
Andrew,
my mom's birthday is tomorrow. We always tease her that she missed
her
true calling by a day.
I'm thinking. Don't you have a grandmother?
What's that?
I was thinking have a grandmother, too, don't you, Andrew?
I do. I do, who turned 103 years old
two
months ago.
That is awesome.
So very, very lucky duck I am to still have a grandmother.
Yeah.
That is great. You're going to read a story coming up. I was hoping they'd come out, President Biden, say that was all an April Fool's joke, what he was talking about yesterday, but I don't think he's done that. This is...
Let me tell you, and then we can unpack it.
Tell people ahead of it, this is, if they're waiting for the end where you say, I'm not serious, it's not going to happen. This is for real.
Right.
Yeah.
This is not a Volkswagen turns Volkswagen situation.
Wish it was.
President Biden outlining his $2 trillion infrastructure plan yesterday in Pittsburgh includes $621 billion for transportation infrastructure, including bridges, roads, public transit, ports, airports, and electric vehicle development. Now, $300 billion would go towards drinking water infrastructure, broadband access, and electric grids. Another $300 billion would go towards affordable housing and upgrading schools. And $580 billion would go towards manufacturing research and development and job training efforts. Here's how the president says he plans to pay for it.
We're going to raise the corporate tax. It was 35%, which was too high. We all agreed 5 years ago it should go down to 28%, but they reduced it to 21%. We're going to raise it back to up to 28%. No one should be able to complain about that. Is still lower than what that rate was between World War II and 2017. Just doing that one thing will generate $1 trillion in additional revenue over 15 years.
And in particular, President Biden also singled out Amazon for not paying federal taxes.
In 2019, an independent analysis found that there are 91 Fortune 500 companies, the biggest companies in the world, including Amazon, that use various loopholes so they pay not a single solitary penny in federal income tax. I don't want to punish them. That's just wrong.
And in response to that jab, an Amazon spokesperson pointing to the R&D tax credit as a loophole that Congress intended that was made permanent in the 2015 law signed by President Obama. So the beginning of a big debate about not just infrastructure unto itself, but, of course, the tax implications for corporations. And of course, later this year, we're expecting to see higher taxes on individuals as well. Yeah. Becky?
My biggest problem with that explanation is, look, if you think there are loopholes that companies are using, the solution isn't to raise the corporate tax rate and punish the people who are actually paying what they're supposed to be paying. The solution is to tighten the loopholes.
Right.
Doing that, too, with the global, which is higher than any other. You know, other countries have talked about a global, like AMT, and they talked about like 12%. Yeah. Who wants to do 21%?
We haven't seen the details on this, but I'm imagining that they probably are going to try to close, I don't know if we'll call them loopholes or whatnot.
Maybe,
but
yep.
I imagine there may be an AMT or something in the United States that comes with this 28% as part of it. We'll have to wait to see. This is what gets me.
You know, we call them loopholes, but sometimes there are things they have asked corporate companies to do. Like,
right.
Are you going to give cuts for research and development? Are you going
to give
cuts for building plants in the United States and employing people here?
Right.
Do you consider those loopholes, or do you consider those things that you are doing to try and motivate companies to spend on the incentives that Washington has deemed important? That's the problem with it, too.
Well, but this is why I think but there is an element where you could get to a point where you do have an AMT of some sort. I don't know. Maybe you'd think that's a fair thing to do. I think for a certain level of company bringing in a certain amount of profit, of real profit, you would think maybe an AMT would work. The other thing, and we talked about it, I think, a week or two ago now, and I think you guys actually talked about it. I think I watched you guys talking about it because I was away a week ago. You know,
you
just
were watching?
How much money is... I happen to be watching. Just how much money has been left on the sidelines because we don't do audits. We don't do audits properly of companies. We don't do audits of individuals.
Right. Yeah,
There's something like a trillion dollars lying around that if you just went and got that $1 trillion, you'd be... Exactly.
Right, the avoidance versus evasion issue.
You guys were talking about it in the context of avoidance versus evasion. I think that those studies, because I actually went back and looked after I was watching, was I think it's evasion. I think what we're talking about is evasion. And I think
if we had an
IRS definitely. That was actually for on the ball.
For the avoidance, you change the law to the way that it gets to where the avoidances are being abused. One thing, let me just point this out. And you know, the Journal has a couple of, and I know it's Rupert Murdoch, blah, blah, blah. But the Journal has a couple of op-eds today that just have some real numbers here. And Dan Clifton, we have him on. I'd like to get him on a day to talk to him if we can. But this polls very well. Infrastructure polls very well because we all think roads, highways, bridges, traditional public works, polls very well. Let's do it. Do you know how much goes towards that, you guys, out of the $1.9 trillion? $115
billion. No.
$115 billion. $115 billion for the $1.9 trillion. Goes for... what everybody is being sold as the infrastructure bill.
Look, I would believe infrastructure also includes things like broadband at this point because I think it's vitally important for homes and businesses to have good broadband.
What you think of traditionally as infrastructure, we all hear about, he talked about it a lot yesterday, the bridges are falling apart, this. I mean, airports too, and that's another $25 billion for airports, you think of that. Ports and waterways, another $17 billion for that. But we're still talking about a small part of the 1.9. And maybe we need charging stations. Jennifer Granholm is going to make that point at Waffle Houses, which I've said they'll pitch in probably too. Waffle Houses and IHOPs, I think we cover the entire country probably. Maybe with a White Castle here and there for lunch. Shipments of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine doses are on hold while the FDA investigates a contamination at a production line in this country, in Baltimore. The ones made over in Europe are fine. The Baltimore plant was run by Emergent BioSolutions. It makes vaccines for J&J as well as AstraZeneca, and workers are accidentally mixed up ingredients. This is not April Fool's, contaminating up to 15 million doses of J&J's vaccine. None of the doses ever left the plant, though, and that lot has itself been quarantined. Is a weird word to use for what you do to a vaccine. J&J says it will strengthen control over the Emergent BioSolutions work. By the way, that stock down sharply, down 8% on the news. Back.
You know, the good news on this was that they caught it. These controls were in place. They caught this before any of it went out. It seems crazy, the idea that you could accidentally mix things up and ruin 15 million doses. But the good news is they caught it. This wasn't like the situation with the Oxford AstraZeneca when they were realizing after the fact, after they dosed all those people, that, oh, we made a mistake, but it actually turned out to be a beneficial one. So how fortunate that we came down this path. The good news is the controls were in place and they caught it. I think that should make people feel pretty good.
It didn't work, or it was dangerous, or both. That's the thing. The messed up vaccines.
Right.
Either it wouldn't work and give you immunity, or was it actually harmful? I think the former. I think
either one's just a terrible situation.
Either one or and both would be.
You go out and think you're immune. Yeah. We do have some breaking news just out from Pfizer. Let's get over to Meg Terrell. She's got that news. Meg, good morning.
Good morning, Becky. A couple pieces of news from Pfizer this morning on its COVID-19 vaccine following up on yesterday's results in 12 to 15-year-olds. The first headline I'll tell you about is that they have data from a trial in South Africa of their vaccine, and it shows very strong protection there. Now, this was a small number of participants, 800 people in this trial. They saw 9 cases of COVID in South Africa, but they were all in the placebo group. 0 cases in South Africa among people who got the vaccine. Now, they sequenced those cases, and they found that 6 of 9 of them were that concerning B1351 variant. And so, early data, but really showing potentially strong protection from the Pfizer vaccine against this variant. And remember, we've seen diminished protection from other vaccines like Johnson & Johnson and Novavax against the B1351 variant. And there's so much concern about this. The NIH has actually already started a trial updating Moderna's vaccine tailored to that variant. These data suggest the original vaccine may be strong enough to cover it. However, science is going to continue, and these are small numbers. Now, the other part of the news from Pfizer this morning is that they have 6-month follow-up data on their phase 3 trial on their COVID-19 vaccine. And essentially, that's enough data and follow-up for them to file for full approval with the FDA. Now, 6 months out from the second dose of the vaccine among 46,000 participants, the vaccine efficacy is shaking out to be about 91.3% effective at 6 months. Against severe disease, depending on how you measure it, it was either 95% or 100% effective in preventing severe disease, guys. So the vaccine continuing to look good, including against these concerning variants, guys.
Meg, that's great news across the board, especially the idea that this is stuff that prevents infection, even with those variants that are out there. The idea that the efficacy after 6 months still looks pretty strong, but maybe not quite as strong. Does that lead you to think that, yes, we will end up taking either booster shots or getting the vaccine again on an annual basis?
It's really not clear at this point. I was talking to Dr. Fauci about this on Monday. How long do these vaccines look like they're going to last? And he was saying, well, we know they last at least 6 to 8 months, but that's only because that's how long they've been following these vaccines.
We don't know how long that 80% is durable. It may drop off a cliff in 2 weeks or 3 weeks. The other thing is that even though it's 80% protective, the level of antibody that it induces is far lower than after the second dose.
Not everybody believes we're going to have to get annual COVID shots the same way we get annual flu shots. It might be less frequent than that. We'll just have to see how these vaccines hold up and how the virus changes. We may end up having to get future COVID shots, and maybe they'll be co-formulated with flu shots, but we just don't have those answers yet.
Real quick, how long would it take for them to file for full FDA approval? How long would it take for the FDA to officially declare it approved? I ask in part because I know a number of business leaders who've been waiting for that, in part because there's been a conversation about whether you could mandate vaccines for return to the office and whatnot. And the view is that as an emergency authorization, there's been legal advice to some that maybe you can't, but that if it was fully approved, that you could.
Yeah, full approval seems to be very important for that. I've talked with legal scholars who don't think that emergency use authorization means that it's illegal for employers to require the vaccination, but it certainly is unpopular. That's something we've absolutely been hearing. In terms of how long it could take the FDA to look at this, typically, you know, it's 6 to 10 months for an FDA review. However, they've already reviewed a lot of these data on the vaccines. And so we've heard about Pfizer getting close to filing. We haven't heard about Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. However, analysts I've spoken with think that all of them could potentially be fully approved in the middle of this year, you know, really preparing us for the fall as universities go back and as employers start to bring people back too.
Okay. The one and only Meg Terrell, what a job you're doing throughout this whole this whole past year, but thank you again.
Next on Squawk Pod, Tom Friedman of the New York Times is hopeful about a Biden spending boom.
This has got to be about smart capitalism, not democratic socialism, nothing else.
Breaking down the White House's $2 trillion infrastructure plan.
If it's done right, it can absolutely be a great and necessary investment in the future. My one concern of the plan is that it's got to be a plan to enable capitalism.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Joe Kernan along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. If you're just joining us, it's April Fool's Day. Don't be fooled. Do not be the fool. Do not have something happen to you where you realize, oh, my God, it's April Fool's Day. So just letting you know it's April Fool's Day. We're all susceptible to really looking silly if we believe something.
News you can use.
I feel like we're going to get gotten somehow over the next hour. It hasn't happened yet, but I feel like we're going to...
The producer just said in my ear, we've got to get moving. And that had to be. That was April. That was April Fool's, wasn't it? I mean, really?
Good luck with that.
Okay, you kill me.
President Biden unveiling a highly anticipated infrastructure plan, saying that now is the time to do something big for an even bigger payoff in the future.
If we act now, in 50 years, people are going to look back and say, this was the moment that America won the future. What I'm proposing is a one-time capital investment of roughly $2 trillion in America's future, spread largely over 8 years, and will generate historic job growth, historic economic growth.
Joining us now to talk about the president's plan, the economy, and American competitiveness is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. Tom's latest piece is The Biden Boom. The president has a chance to supercharge the economy. And Tom, welcome. It's good to see you.
Good to be with you guys.
So I think the headline and what we just read about your latest piece is enough to kind of see where you come down on this. Biden says that this is an investment in the future, and it sounds like you agree with that.
Yeah, I think if it's done right, Becky, it can absolutely be a great and necessary investment in the future. Particularly if we keep it tightly focused in two ways. The first is let's focus on roads, rural broadband, ports, airports, the things that are actually the enabling tools of the economy. That would be the first thing. The second is on making sure that we use the government in the right way here, which is that the government enabled the private sector, especially in the energy area, and where basically the government uses its buying power to buy power, to basically bring technologies down the cost volume curve. And then you let the private sector develop these technologies with the right performance standards. It's that combination that works best. We got to get each side doing the right thing. My one concern of the plan, and this was what my column was about yesterday, is that it's got to be a plan to enable capitalism. If you want to have a green economy, there's only one way you can have a truly green economy, and that's if you have scale. And the only thing that gives you scale is the market, the private sector driving these things forward. So if each side plays their right role, I think this has great potential.
Hey, Tom, I think what you just laid out is something that most people would agree with, particularly the idea that we have got to spend on bridges, on roads, on ports, on airports, and on broadband. We've been talking about that since the show started at 6 a.m. This is a long overdue investment, something that we've been hearing about for years and years, something that has never happened. But I think people would take issue with whether this bill does everything that you just described, whether this bill lays it out the right way, and whether you really need north of $2 trillion to make this investment happen.
Yeah, and I think that's all. I see this, Beck, as the government or Biden's opening bid. I think it will be whittled down and reshaped both by Republicans and I think by conservative Democrats. As it's debated more publicly, so he's asked for the moon, but I think there'll be and should be and needs to be a real debate about how we focus this and make sure we get the absolute bang for our buck. Because Becky, we're not going to get another chance to do another $2-3 trillion plan, so we really have to get this right.
You just said we're not going to get another chance to do a $2 to $3 trillion plan. How is this going to be whittled down if we're still talking about spending $2 to $3 trillion? And by the way, this is just the down payment on infrastructure. They've got another one waiting in the wings that's going to do all kinds of things, propose things for childcare and far beyond.
Yeah, for my money, you know, that should be down the road right now, because to me, you really want to focus on the truly enabling infrastructure that can launch the private sector, that this has got to be about smart capitalism, you know, not democratic socialism, nothing else. That's my approach. That's what I will be arguing for. I'm not the author of the bill, but that's what my column was trying to advocate. You do that right, Beck. I think this moment has great potential, because think about it. Never have more people had access to cheap, high-powered computing through the cloud than they have today. Never have more things been digitized. We digitized like 10 years worth of things in the last year. Never have more people had access to cheap capital, and never have there been more problems to solve. So, you know, the raw material is there for a real explosion of creative destruction if we make sure the government doesn't overwhelm it or doesn't shortchange it. It's got to be done right. And that's what the debate's going to be about. You guys will be out there. I'm going to be out there. The lawmakers are going to be out there. Many people are going to weigh in. And I think we all have to make sure we get this as absolutely right as possible.
The way things usually get done in Congress is you keep putting more things in to scratch somebody else's back, to convince them to vote for a bill, even though there are things in it that they don't like. I don't think I've ever seen a real process legislatively succeed where you say, OK, what you just laid out is a very sound foundation for things. But when you do that, you lose the Elizabeth Warrens, you lose the Bernie Sanders if you strip out some of those things. And honestly, we've all watched this process take place. The way it usually works is to make sure that Manchin's going to vote for this. There's going to be a whole bunch of things that he wants, you know, for manufacturing in his areas, for places that are coal manufacturing areas. That we've already seen it. Some of the proposals that have been brought up to make sure that there's Made in America and more manufacturing that's taking place there to ensure that he will vote for things that he has said he won't vote for. And I can see that playing out, you know, dozens of times as this bill kind of works its way through.
Yeah, we're going to see the full messiness of a pork-laden democracy. There's no question about it. We always have. I wasn't around in the 50s when we did the interstate highway system. But I'm sure there was plenty of that going on at the time, too. But it did give us the kind of transportation infrastructure that we have today. So you just hope the waste can be kept down to a minimum. But this is really important. You know, China is hurtling ahead on these same kind of technologies. And if we want to be competitive, we're going to have to take this very, very seriously. And there are ways of funding it, too, which I would be looking at. You know, there's no gasoline tax in here. There's no carbon tax. There's only tax on basically corporate earnings. And, you know, we haven't raised the gasoline tax, Becky, since 1993. And it wasn't even indexed to inflation. So I just think I look at this as the opening of the discussion. And the president's asking for the moon. Great. But I'm going to do what I can to help it be an intelligent discussion and not some pie in the sky thing.
We're going to raise zero gas taxes when everybody's driving an EV, Tom.
Well, everyone, it's going to be wild, Joe. I wish everyone were driving an EV, but it's going to be
wild.
No,
but you know what I mean. The richest Tesla drivers use all our roads and our bridges, and they aren't going to pay anything in a gas tax.
But there's ways to get around that, you know, Joe. I think one is a carbon tax. So it's going to be a long time before, you know, we're all driving EVs. So
do you think it's a good idea that we still force that's the Journal's piece today, Tom, that we force feed consumers EVs even when they're not really affordable for most people and they don't make economic sense? Or a lot of times if you're not in an urban area, it's tough even, you know, to envision if you have a long commute that you could use one.
Yeah, here's what I think, Joe. I think this is a case where you use, again, the buying power of the government to drive down that technology down the cost volume curve. We've done that before in the past. Okay, maybe a mandate that every government vehicle is going to be an EV. You get the cost down where it can scale. I mean, you know, Chevy the Chevy Volt, you know, GM has you know, announced they're going deep into EVs. I don't think they're doing that as a as just some, you know, green goopy charity measure. I mean, I think they really see the future there. The key is use the government's balance sheet to drive costs down and then let the private sector take over.
Right. And Volkswagen, too. Volkswagen.
Sucker. It's not Volkswagen, sucker. Tom, thank you. I think we need you to keep shining a spotlight on this, the things that make sense, the things that don't, because it's going to get complicated. It's going to get ugly. But thanks for your time, and we'll talk to you soon about it.
Always anytime, Beck. Thanks.
It's opening day for the MLB. Boston Red Sox chairman Tom Warner couldn't be happier to bring fans back to the field.
I'm hopeful that by August there will be a return to normal at Fenway Park. I would certainly hope that by the end of the season, stadiums will be at full capacity.
And another job for Elon Musk?
I just like that they had to verify that this was not an April Fool's joke.
Right.
He's a busy man, Elon Musk.
He is.
Squawk Pod will be right back. Welcome back to Squawk Pod. Red Sox fans are returning to Fenway Park for the first time in over a year. Fenway is limited to 12% capacity, and fans are required to complete a health screening survey prior to entry on the MLB Ballpark app. To put that in perspective, about 4,500 fans will be in the stands, while the stadium usually hosts 40,000. Today, the Red Sox will also welcome over 100 healthcare heroes through a partnership with Dell Technologies. Boston Red Sox chairman and legendary TV producer, he brought Roseanne and That 70 Show to the air. Tom Warner joins us to discuss how he plans to keep fans and players safe with the return of live sports events. Here's Joe.
It's opening day, reopening day for the MLB. This season shaping up to be a step towards a return to normal. Fenway Park opens this afternoon at 12% capacity, but at least it's 12%. Joining us now is Tom Warner, chairman of the Boston Red Sox and Fenway Sports Group. Tom, I was laughing a little bit because these last couple of days, there's nothing going on. No, you know, the NCAA, you know, that's not happening. Even the ladies. So I looked at today. I had like 15 things I looked at, and I know you're the Red Sox are starting out with the Orioles. The over/under is 9.5, Tom. We're expecting some big things offensively from the Red Sox this year. Okay. Will we see that?
Well, we had a great spring training. We're coming off of a somewhat mediocre season last year, but I think we've upgraded our staff and our squad. And, you know, baseball in spring is always an exciting combination. I'm really excited that we're having fans at Fenway Park. I know you mentioned that we only have 12% capacity, but we haven't had fans at Fenway Park in 18 months. So I'm excited about opening day.
You know, trending. A lot of people say they couldn't sleep last night. And it's always a great thing. And, you know, the baseball season was played last year, but it will be great to get back to hopefully 162 games. And are there still seven-inning doubleheaders, Tom? Is that still going to happen? Yeah. And that was a great idea, putting someone on second base. Right? Is that not a great idea in an extra innings game?
I think that we've made some improvements to the content of the game, and I think we're going to continue to make more improvements. But I'm a big fan of seven-inning doubleheaders, and obviously I'm concerned about pace of play, and I think that that's a good step forward.
When do you expect comps to be similar to what we were used to? Well, it won't be this year, obviously, at 12%, but vaccines are going out. By the end of the year, where do you think we'll be in terms of the stadium?
I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful that by August there will be a return to normal at Fenway Park and other venues. I certainly don't have a crystal ball, but we're hoping that, as you said, the vaccine rollout continues to be expeditious. And I would certainly hope that by the end of the season, stadiums will be at full capacity.
You saw the NFL's streaming news and just the overall news of what sports content is worth. Baseball is a little bit different. There's a lot more, obviously, but I think baseball might even be better in terms of local markets. Are you going to be able to cash in on the sport itself, on just the voracious appetite for live events?
I do think that the bond that that fans have with their local sports team is so strong. And in an era of disruption, sports really is must carry, whether it's the NFL or the NBA or MLB. And I'm looking forward to a return to normal because the relationship that people have with their local sports team is so strong that I'm excited about, you know, seeing those returns.
Tom, are you cautiously optimistic about the safety protocols that are put in will not cause the big long quarantines and you know, rescheduling games, canceling games? Are we beyond that yet in terms of the pandemic, do you think? Or will we see that scattered cancellations and players being in quarantine, things like that?
Well, I certainly think that we've gone beyond where we were 6 months ago. The protocols in baseball are very strong. The players are heeding them. They're quite extensive. But sure, I think there might be an occasional outbreak, but I do think that it will be a rare event if some games are canceled.
How's the labor situation? Do we have years and years not to worry about things like that? Is it a lot of harmony between owners and players and salary caps and everything else? What has been your experience with the Red Sox this year?
Well, I think it's in everybody's best interest to come to an agreement with the players. I know that there are conversations already starting between the commissioner and Tony Clark, and I expect that we'll come to a resolution. It's in nobody's best interest to have the business of baseball be on the front pages. And you know, the baseball is a thriving business. Before the pandemic, I think revenues in baseball were above $10 billion, and it's going to continue to grow. And it's in everybody's interest to resolve any of their disputes quickly and quietly.
Do you guys sit around and gals sit around talking about digital and how to maximize in the new media world that we're in? And even, I don't know, gaming, well, I don't want to bring up Pete Rose, but I think it's fun to try and figure out baseball. I never win, but I think it's fun to try and figure out how to bet on baseball. That's gonna be incrementally better, I think, as that expands, right?
Well, we're certainly interested in finding the fan, the consumer, wherever he is, whether he's watching baseball on satellite or cable or his mobile phone. And you know, I know that there are going to be a lot of direct-to-consumer initiatives, but you know, wherever the fan is at, hopefully we'll find he or she there.
Yeah, who's pitching today? Because I did look at the Red Sox, and I'm planning on, you know, I don't know, Baltimore, are they any better this year? I should recuse myself because I did put $3 on the Red Sox, and I actually did take the under.
As you know, I can't bet on baseball, but I think Nate Eovaldi will pitch a great game today, and we'll be off to a good start.
And offensively, there were some shortfalls last year. I used to think I think of the Red Sox, and I just think of a lot of runs, and that didn't happen as much as I had hoped last year. It's going to happen this year.
We're going to be strong offensively, and hopefully better defensively.
Okay. Any opinion on whether the Reds are going to be any good this year? We got to go, but.
The Reds are going to be good, and the Red Sox will be good.
All right. I wish we had more time. Got some other teams to ask you about. The Yankees have a lot of offense. Anyway, thank you, Tom Werner. Good luck.
Right.
We'll be watching Fenway. I like saying Fenway. It just makes me feel good for some reason.
Come up and see us soon.
All right. We will.
Elon Musk has been nominated to join the board of directors at Endeavor Group Holdings. That's the company that owns the UFC, the Miami Open, New York Fashion Week, and the Miss Universe pageant, not to mention all of the people that company represents. The company began as a talent agency, started by Hollywood agent Ari Emanuel. It's now planning to go public, and it wants Musk to be one of its 11 directors. Musk will still need to be elected to the board. Investors in Endeavor, including Elliott Management and Silver Lake Partners, confirmed that the nomination of Musk is not an April Fool's prank. So there you go.
Andrew, and I don't think that's not your agent, Beck, but WME Endeavor our agent. And Ari, he's like, remember Johnny Carson? Well, that's a long time ago. We used to talk about Bombastic Bushkin, and so I always call Ari that sometimes, Bombastic Bushkin. But
Entourage.
From Entourage, obviously. But some of the stuff that we didn't mention, they're buying all of UFC. And UFC, I guess we didn't understand what a cash generator that was and how well it would do during the pandemic, because it did. And it really helped Endeavor, which I don't know if you'd say it went through a difficult period, but you know, they made a lot of acquisitions. Remember, Andrew planned to go public, and it was before the pandemic, and the IPO market dried up. It dried up very quickly, and Endeavor did not, the environment wasn't conducive to going public, so they pulled that offering, and they did have some debt, and, you know, a lot of the partners were promised stock and a way of monetizing some of the holdings in the company. And it was a bit of a setback because of market conditions more than anything. So now able to go back and a much better time.
And it's so fascinating that the UFC piece of it has actually been the outperformer, because if you remember what happened when COVID first hit and all of a sudden there were questions about what was happening or what would happen to Endeavor, part of it was this view that nobody would ever come back to events, UFC, they doubled down on UFC, and that actually that was going to hurt other parts of the business. Of course, other parts of the business hit by the fact that movies weren't being made and the like. So, but it's so interesting sort of how all these things come full circle, and almost counterintuitively so, given where people's heads were at the beginning of this and where they are now. And that's almost happened across the board in the business world.
I just like that they had to verify that this was not an April Fool's joke, that Elon Musk would be joining the board.
That didn't occur to me,
but it's probably a good question to ask.
Not the IPO. The Elon Musk became a headline. But they also have some other stuff, too, rodeos and all that stuff. But I actually rented one of those, the Conor McGregor fight. I lost money on that one. But it's pretty compelling.
Here is the question. If you are a shareholder of Tesla, or a shareholder of SpaceX, or a shareholder of privately of the Boring Company. I don't know if they've actually sold. Are you happy that he's joining another board? He's a busy man, Elon Musk.
He is. He's multi-talented.
I mean, even just tweeting is a job unto itself.
Yep.
That's Squawk Pod for today. On our rundown tomorrow, we have a very special interview with who might be Squawk Box's biggest fan. And he's a teenager.
First of all, I got to ask you, how old are you?
I'm 15.
How in the world do you do what you do?
CNBC is basically everything to me. CNBC, I love it.
Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you right back here tomorrow.